Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we want to start today with a check-in on Afghanistan, where U.S. and Afghan officials are confirming that top Taliban militants are being shepherded from their strongholds to Kabul by U.S. and NATO forces. This is for peace talks with senior members of the Afghan government, including President Hamid Karzai. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Brussels today for a NATO meeting had this reaction to the talks on ABC's Good Morning America.
I think it's highly unlikely that the leadership of the Taliban that refused to turn over bin Laden in 2001 will ever reconcile. But, you know, stranger things have happened in the history of war.
Julian Barnes is Pentagon correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And Julian, let's start with this image of U.S. troops, you know, safeguarding Taliban leaders. We know there have been attempts at talks before, but that image is pretty interesting. What's your sense?
Well, it is an interesting development. It's an important development. You know, if the U.S. And NATO did not say, we will grant safe passage here, the Taliban leaders wouldn't be able to participate in the talks. I mean, any sort of movement to the heart of Afghanistan, to the capital, these folks would likely be picked up and targeted. So it is a necessity to have this sort of safe passage agreement.
Well, but on the other hand, you hear Secretary of State Clinton say, well, whatever, it might or might not work. So she's not sounding as if she's, you know, perhaps the one who okayed troops accompanying the Taliban. What are you reading into that?
This is a shift, but there still is great skepticism within the Obama administration about whether this will work. There's great skepticism within the uniformed military as well. I think Secretary Clinton's views there echo a lot of what you hear, you know, down the chain of command. There are senior military officers who say, I'm not sure this will work at this point, but it can't hurt us, you know. At this point, if we talk, we'll sort of know what their position is. We'll get a better understanding of where they are. Meanwhile, we intensify our military pressure and, you know, perhaps we make our bargaining position better.
Well, meanwhile, you quote a senior Pakistani official who says America is not just accompanying people to get them to the talks. America is in the talks but has not revealed itself. Is that true?
I don't know how true it is, but I think what that senior Pakistan official is getting at is, you know, these talks don't go anywhere without the blessing of the U.S. Allowing safe passage sort of gives a public blessing to the talks. It then gives the various negotiating parties a little more confidence. I take the senior officials at their word that the U.S. does not have a formal seat at the table.
And what is your sense? Yes, we hear the skepticism, but what's the sense that talks might work, especially since the U.S. is demanding that the Taliban agree to the Afghan constitution, which gives rights to women, for instance?
I think that there could be some success. You know, the Taliban movement is very fractured. You're not going to have the kind of peace deal where, you know, there's a signing statement on the USS Missouri and all fighting ends. You're going to have deals with some factions, and that could decrease the levels of violence. You could find ways to bring some factions into the government. That could make it more stable. Will there be peace with Mullah Omar? I doubt that.
Mullah Omar, who's the spiritual leader of the Taliban and living in exile in Pakistan.
Right, and he's very close to al-Qaeda. He's very hardcore. He has not, publicly, has not given his blessing to these talks.
Yeah. And meanwhile, these talks come as the U.S. is committed to a timeline of starting to remove troops from Afghanistan by next summer. But it's also been the deadliest year for international forces there, and the AP is reporting the NATO commitment to the war effort is waning. So might this also have to do with, you know, a push to at least try talks?
I think it does, for at least one reason, which is key U.S. partners, namely Britain, as well as some other NATO partners, want these talks to go on. They have been backers of reconciliation talks, even when the U.S. government was opposed to them. And so by doing this, the U.S. wins points with NATO leaders. They also win points with Karzai, who wants the talks.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Julian, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, last year, the Supreme Court ruled that there are limits on DNA testing after someone's been convicted. The ruling was trumped somewhat by the fact that 48 states allow somewhat broader access. But this week, the court is considering a Texas death row inmate's claim that his state is too narrow. Texas is telling him his attorneys had the DNA evidence but didn't use it. He missed his chance. Well, luckily, the man at the center of a new movie didn't have that problem. When Kenny Waters was convicted of murder in 1983, there was no DNA testing. Years later, his sister would hatch a plan to use it.
I'm going to get Kenny out. There were no DNA tests then. They only knew the murderer was type O, and so was Kenny. But now, if we can DNA test the murderer's blood and Kenny's, it'll prove Kenny's innocent. Just like in the rape case.
Wait, so how do you know the blood evidence still exists?
Because we can find it.
And she did. That's Hilary Swank playing Betty Ann Waters, a Rhode Island working mom and high school dropout who put herself through law school in an 18-year crusade to prove her brother's innocence and overturn his murder conviction. And Farrah Stockman says, as gripping as the film about her is, it doesn't hold a candle to real life. Farrah Stockman is with the Boston Globe. You've heard her reports on Iraq, Afghanistan. But Farrah, in 2001, you were a cub reporter when you got a phone call from Barry Scheck, who ran the Innocence Project. Tell us about the call.
I was just manning the phones and get a call from a guy who says, hey, I got a great story for you. And he tells me the story of this woman who, against all odds, had gone to law school and all with the goal of freeing her brother from prison. And he says, tomorrow this man is going to walk free. Do you want to cover the story? And I said, sure. And we wrote it and we put it on the front page. And I got calls right away saying, oh, did you buy her life rights? And I was like, what are life rights? I didn't know what they were talking about. I called her up and said, here's the number of someone who wants to talk to you.
Oh, well. So
right.
Now the film comes along. Let's talk a little bit more about what happened so we can better understand the film. First of all, there was a woman who was robbed and murdered in Ayr, Massachusetts. Why was Kenny Waters even a suspect?
Kenny was kind of a town troublemaker. He had a drinking problem. He was often picked up by the cops. In fact, one of his main alibis was that he was in court the morning of the murder for another charge. Okay. And so he was sort of a known troublemaker in town. And as a kid, he had broken into her trailer. And he apparently always resented her afterwards because it sent him to reform school. And during the trial, he had two of his ex-girlfriends testify that he admitted to the murder.
Well, that would seem pretty damning. And so Kenny was convicted. And in this scene from the movie, he's serving life with no chance of parole and has just tried to kill himself when Betty Ann, again played by Hilary Swank, visits and tells him what she's going to do.
I'm going to stop by trying to get a B.A., after I finally take the stupid GED test, and after that, if I even get that far, and there's no guarantee I'll even get in, I'll apply to law school. But I mean, it's gonna take a long time, Kenny, a really long time. And I mean, I might be 80 years old before I finally become a lawyer, and even then, I still don't know if I'm gonna find the answers. But you just have to promise me that you won't ever try to kill yourself ever again. Because if you do,
okay.
Farrah, why did Betty Ann believe so much that her brother was innocent?
She had good reason, I think, to believe in his innocence, more even than the movie gets into, because the director wanted us to wonder, in a way, whether Kenny was innocent or not. They didn't even portray all the real hard evidence that had been ignored by the court.
You write about some of them. And by the way, if you haven't seen the movie yet, you know, spoiler alert here. You mentioned the ex-girlfriends who testified against him. In real life, didn't at least one of them confess to Betty Ann that that wasn't true?
Yes. One of these ex-girlfriends came sobbing to Betty Ann right after his conviction and said that she was kind of railroaded and, you know, the cops got her drunk and told her to say these things, and she really apologized. And this was what Betty Ann thought was going to get Kenny out of prison. And so she tape records this and she puts it into his appeal. And then they stick her on the stand and she changes her story yet again.
Well, they might also have included the person who was running the case for the town of Ayr. Let's first play a scene from the film. It's the character of police officer Nancy Taylor, played as sort of a really tough cop by Melissa Leo. In the scene, she's confronting Kenny Waters as he's clearing wood on a farm, and she's trying to take him in for questioning. Let's listen.
Sir, I need you to step into the patrol car.
Well, my grandpa needs this tree out of here.
Now, Mr. Waters, put down the chainsaw.
So, tough cop, put down the chainsaw. But in real life, who really was Nancy Taylor?
Nancy Taylor was the secretary for the police chief, and they gave her investigatory power over rape cases and some other cases, and she started playing the role of an investigator when she hadn't been trained. And in fact, after Kenny came out of prison, Betty Ann won a wrongful prosecution, a malicious prosecution case against Nancy Taylor because she found more evidence. She found fingerprint evidence that she said should have been presented at the time of his trial, which would have excluded him from the very beginning. And Betty Ann maintains that, in fact, this secretary was kind of trying to get ahead in the 80s in this male-dominated profession, and she did this by putting people away and hiding evidence and that sort of thing. So this is what Betty Ann's thesis is, and in fact, when she presented this evidence, the town of Ayer settled for, I think, $3.1 million, and the one insurance company for the town that didn't settle was forced by a judge to pay like $10 million. So Betty Ann's case was pretty strong.
And what is the town saying now about the fact that a police chief had a secretary run murder and rape cases? Because there was another case. Not only did Betty Ann later find this box in which there was this fingerprint evidence that had just been sort of tucked away, there was another Ayer man, Dennis Maher, who was also exonerated by the Innocence Project for a rape he didn't commit, and his investigation also involved this Nancy Taylor Harris, again, a town secretary.
I tried to speak to Nancy Taylor, and she wouldn't talk to me. I can imagine she's not happy about the movie. The police chief at the time has issued a statement saying he believes that Kenneth Waters should have been retried and that there was ample evidence to convict him even without the DNA evidence. I think the town probably just wants to move on from this. This has been a huge liability for them.
Well, Farrah Stockman, just a couple questions. There are epilogues to this story that aren't in the film. First of all, Betty Ann, who, you know, 18 years to become a lawyer, frees her brother. Yes, she's still involved with the Innocence Project. But did she go back to work at the bar?
Yes, she doesn't want to practice law. She really was trying to help her brother.
Isn't that something?
So, yeah.
Well, and there's another much sadder epilogue. The film ends Betty Ann and her brother sitting at a picnic table talking about the dreams they used to have as kids. What was the real life ending?
That was much more heartbreaking and strange. He had a very funny press conference right after he came out, and then 6 months later we hear that he's in the hospital because he hit his head. He climbed a fence and hit his head and ultimately died.
Mm. So sad. In fact, the filmmakers felt too sad for audiences, but it's true. Farrah Stockman, a reporter with the Boston Globe, who broke the story about Betty Ann Waters' 18-year crusade to free her brother from prison. It's now the subject of the film Conviction. When we come back, what was that like? Incredible success followed by such sadness? We'll ask the real Betty Ann Waters here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the new film Conviction, or rather, the real-life story behind it, the story of Betty Ann Waters, a Rhode Island working mom. She worked at Aiden's Pub in Bristol, Rhode Island. She was a high school dropout who put herself through law school on an 18-year crusade to get her brother Kenny, known as Muddy, out of prison for a crime they both believed he didn't commit, and DNA testing ultimately proved he didn't commit. It's a fascinating story in and of itself, but more so as the Supreme Court considers limits on DNA testing after someone's been convicted. And we now welcome Betty Ann Waters herself. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Boy, talk about, you know, that was an 18-year crusade to get your brother out of jail and then add about 10 more years on, and here we have the film. But,
yeah.
But we also want to start with condolences because it's just unbelievable. And I guess it was too shocking, the filmmakers felt, to put in the film. But, you know, Kenny died just 6 months after getting out of prison.
Yes. It's very shocking, and I'm happy that's not in the film, though, because the film was not about him dying. It was about him being free.
But your brother had a really full 6 months.
He absolutely did.
My brother was excited about having a movie made. I think he thought he was going to be in it, you know, and probably cast it, you name it. So if it showed him dying, it just would not have been the same movie. So it's exactly the way it should have been.
Yeah. Was he resentful at losing all those years?
You know, he wasn't. He was only out 6 months, as you know, and he was just ready to live life. He wasn't going to waste time being resentful. But I don't know how it would have turned out later, you know, because I think he was starting to go to counseling at the time that he had that fatal fall. It wasn't going to be easy. It was like you said, it was like he was in a war, and like coming home from a war. So it definitely wasn't going to be like, oh, yeah, now I'm out, now everything is great.
Yeah. Well, meantime, he comes out, and suddenly there's this thing called cell phones, and life has changed so much.
Everything has changed. Everybody moved on. Everybody has children. You know, they're grown. They have homes. And Kenny had nothing.
Yeah.
You know, so it was not going to be easy, that's for sure.
Well, and that's maybe why we were stunned to learn, Betty Ann, that you spent all these years, 18-year crusade, going up, putting yourself through law school, so much that you sacrificed along the way. You went back to the bar that you had worked at?
Well, I never left. I've always worked there.
But why didn't you continue with law? Because we know you kept up your fierce interest in the wrongly incarcerated.
And I still do help the Innocence Project. I always will. I have tremendous respect and admiration for Gary Shack. He's my hero. And I do things with him to try to do policy changes and reforms. I speak against the death penalty or anything he asks me to do, believe me, I will do.
Well, one of the things that you work on is evidence preservation. And that's, you know, one of the most stunning parts of the story is that there was evidence hidden away in a box that should have been presented at trial. You find this later, and then you find out it happened in another case that the secretary of the sheriff, who was, you know, prosecuting these cases without any training.
Yeah.
How does someone accept something like that?
It's devastating, and it happens all the time. This is what Barry Sheck is up against all the time. He's trying to fight for a simple thing like, let's have a preservation statute that says don't destroy evidence. You know, and some states, they don't want it. They just, you know, the appeal's done, you're done, it's over with, which is why? Because, first of all, none of us knew that DNA would exist 20 years ago. You know, what's going to happen in 20 years from now that we'll find out that could help other innocent people in prison or even more so help find the guilty people?
Well, and I'm wondering, too, with that in mind, your thoughts on this U.S. Supreme Court case that we mentioned, the court considering an appeal from a Texas death row inmate, Hank Skinner, who wants DNA evidence that had not been presented at his trial to be examined.
Right. You know, something I know a little bit about that case, because I think I wrote into the governor to not execute him. Why not test the evidence?
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, there is a case in Texas right now that Barry is working on. This man was already executed, and he was accused of arson that killed three of his children. And I think it's about to be proved that he was wrongly convicted and executed.
How do you? Yes, you have a film. yes, you got your brother out, but he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you became a lawyer, but in the process, from what we understand, lost your marriage. At one point, your two terrific kids decide they want to go live with their dad.
Yeah, that was only for a year, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it seems like a lot of sacrifice. And you know how the families feel who also feel that their loved ones are wrongly convicted.
I know. It's horrible. I have a lot of bad days thinking about it because, well, you know something? On the other hand, I'm very fortunate that I get to be a person that might be able to help. And this movie might be able to help both other people that will make people like you and I, because I know I, before my brother was convicted, always thought guilty people were in prison. And I learned really quick that that's not true. And I've met over the 259 exonerees through DNA. I've met probably a couple hundred of those, which I love so much. And it's like, now I know. And this movie will open people's eyes, and maybe somebody will do something or not do something and another person will go free that deserves to be free, that's innocent. And if this movie does that and I get to be a part of that, you know, I'll die a happy woman.
Betty Ann Waters, enjoy your moment. And we just we thought, in tribute to your brother Kenny, we might play a little Muddy Waters.
Oh, I love you. Thank you. Oh, you know why they named him that?
Why?
Well, because the first 2 years in prison, he didn't talk to anybody. It was like he had the blues.
Oh.
They named him Muddy, and the name stuck with him all those years.
Oh.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Betty Ann, again, enjoy your moment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Again, that's Betty Ann Waters, the former high school dropout who became a lawyer and overturned her brother's murder conviction. Her story is told in the film Conviction, which opens this weekend. For more on the film and the Innocence Project, go to our website, hereandnow.org. And while there, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Just click on Contact Us or scroll down and leave a comment right there. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Rock me all night long.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had strong words today about the beheading of that Mexican detective who was investigating last month's jet skiing murder on the Texas-Mexico border. Clinton said the absolute barbarity shows what the U.S. is dealing with. The detective was beheaded after announcing two members of the Zeta drug cartel as suspects in the death of tourist David Hartley. Yesterday, Stratfor, a Texas-based intelligence company, suggested that Hartley may have been mistaken for another drug cartel spy. Farah Fazal is a reporter for KRGV-TV in the Rio Grande Valley. She joins us on her cell phone. And Farah, this Mexican detective was beheaded only days after meeting with you. How chilling this must be.
Extremely chilling. In fact, that Mexican investigator, Comandante Rolando Flores Villegas, gave this information to Mexican media on Saturday. On Sunday, he met with us to give us that same information. In that information, these documents contain the names of two brothers who are the leaders, apparently, of the Zeta cartel who run the area around Old Guerrero where David Hartley was murdered. Shortly after giving us those documents, on the Tuesday, we got information that his head was cut off, put in a suitcase, and left at the Army garrison in Miguel Alemán. That has sent really a chill through the entire investigation. As you can imagine, all of the players in this story now see this investigation just a little differently.
Well, and I was going to say, how has it affected the investigation? Has anybody pulled back? There was already criticism that Mexican officials weren't being aggressive enough.
I just got off the phone with the Zapata County Sheriff, and he tells me that yesterday he went out on the waters to sweep the area to see if there was any Mexican investigators by air, by land, in the water, and he could not see anybody. He usually has daily contact with those Mexican investigators, and he has not been able to reach them for the last 24 hours. He tried again this morning. He still couldn't reach them.
Well, we mentioned this intelligence company, Stratfor, which thinks that David Hartley might have been mistaken for another cartel spy. They also say that his body was likely destroyed by cartel members to damage control. You spoke with the county sheriff in Texas this morning. Does he think Hartley was a victim of mistaken identity?
There's two schools of thought on this. The Zapata County Sheriff got this information and this intelligence really way before, days before, and his assessment is that he just really believes the Hartleys were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Does he agree with the wife that these were just tourists out and maybe wrong place, wrong time, and one shot?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He has said that really from the very beginning.
Right.
He is one of the first believers of Tiffany Hartley, if you remember. There was a lot of speculation that she was not telling the truth. Maybe she'd made up this bizarre story of her husband who got killed on the Mexican side of the lake. He also told me that, you know, the fact is that there were two things that they should not have done. They probably should not have been on jet skis, because the Zetas see that as a threat. They see people coming onto jet skis onto their territory as somebody trying to deal drugs on that territory, and they are very, very protective of that territory. And he also said, you know, it's really a good idea when tourists get into town to stop by tackle shops and guides and find out from them, hey, what's going on at the lake today? You know, should I go over there? Is everything okay?
Meanwhile, Farah, we understand you're heading over to Falcon Lake right now. Can you feel the presence of these drug cartels when you're there?
Absolutely. I can tell you, Robin, a couple of days ago, I was talking to some fishermen and also some victims of other pirate attacks on the lake. And as we stood talking, the fisherman said to me, look over there. They're watching us. They know that you are talking to me. They know who you are, and they're just watching to see what you're going to do. If I talk to you on camera, that's probably not going to be a good thing for me. There's a real sense here that the cartels are omnipresent, and they have really controlled Falcon Lake for a long, long time. And right now, it is very difficult for the cartels because there are so many eyes on the lake, Robin. There's the Coast Guard, the game wardens, the Border Patrol. Everybody is out there manning this lake on the U.S. side, and they cannot traffic their drugs.
Farah Fazal, reporter for KRGV-TV in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. Farah, thank you.
It is my pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Incredible story. Well, we'll be back in 30 seconds with a look at mine safety here and now. Chile's 33 freed miners resting and being checked by doctors in a hospital met with President Sebastián Piñera today. Most of the miners are doing well, but many were unable to sleep. One was treated for pneumonia. Two needed dental work, and several will be released today, returning to life above ground. President Piñera says that the successful rescue of all 33 men will bring Chile a new level of respect around the world. But the billionaire businessman turned politician also said Chile must learn from this experience. Never again in our country, he said, will we permit people to work in conditions so unsafe and inhumane as they were in the San Jose mine and in many other places in our country. Well, the mine, which had been open for more than 100 years, did have a checkered safety record. And every year around the world, 10 to 20,000 miners are killed in accidents. China's the worst offender. The Chinese government admits to more than 3,000 deaths in its mines every year, but most observers think the number's much higher. As the BBC's Paul Moss reports, there are plenty of other countries where mining continues to be a dangerous and often fatal job.
Heart-rending scenes in the eastern Donetsk region of Ukraine. The year was 2007, and a local coal mine had collapsed after methane gas exploded deep underground. Relatives gathered at a local hospital. In the end, more than 100 miners were killed. The explosion at the Zasyadko mine was unusually lethal. But in fact, more than 100 Ukrainian miners die in accidents every year. Mines there are particularly dangerous because they're particularly deep. But according to the safety campaigner Oksana Abud, there are other reasons so many lives are lost.
The main problem is that our mines in Ukraine, they are very old. And if you go underground, you are like in prison. There is no enough light there. And a lot of work is done by hand, not by any modern technique.
It's not only the less industrially developed countries that have accidents in their mines. Earlier this year, 25 American miners were killed at Moncol, West Virginia. Once again, relatives waited forlornly for news of their loved ones.
They asked me if Kevin was working the evening or day. That's all they said. They told me there'd been an explosion.
Before the Moncol explosion, accident rates in U.S. mines had been declining. But still, 18 miners lost their lives there last year, and miners' leader Dan Kane insists there's no need for that death toll in a modern industrialized country. He blames a deep-seated antipathy towards workers' health and safety.
The general attitude in this country right now is sort of reduce regulation. We got to get the government off your back. And there are not enough inspectors to see what's going on. There's no place better to hide something than in a coal mine. The government has to be there and regulate this industry.
For coal is black and coal is red, and coal is rich beyond the treasure.
The first attempt to regulate mining began in the United Kingdom. Back in the 19th century, Britain led the world in coal production, but its mines had an appallingly high rate of accidents to match.
For 47 brave men are dead.
Mine regulation came in partly as a result of pressure from the miners' trade unions. And the trade unions have an equally important role to play today, according to the ICEM, an international federation of miners' unions based in Geneva. The ICEM spokesman is Joe Drexler.
A worker that does not have a trade union does not have the power to refuse unsafe work, the power to challenge the employer. Wherever you find a trade union present at a mine, you will find that, for the most part, the number of fatalities, the number of injuries, are far less compared to non-union mines.
But there's one country where independent trade unions are not allowed, and which happens to be the world's biggest producer of coal. China digs up 3 billion tons of coal every year, and every year at least 3,000 of its miners die in the process. Some believe the true figure is more like 8,000. And yet this grim situation is being challenged. 3 years ago, an accident at a Chinese mine prompted unprecedented protests by local people. And there have now been new safety laws introduced, so that if workers are killed at a Chinese mine, the managers and local officials are supposed to take the blame. Shuji Yao is professor of Chinese economics and politics at Nottingham University, and claims this new approach is working.
Coal mining death toll attracts significant media attention immediately, and this is why the government pay much more attention to this. So each time, if there's a large-scale disaster, there is always some official got punishment who lost their job. And managers of the mines, they could be put into prisons. This reduced the death toll significantly.
Over in South Africa, miners decided not to wait for their government to take action. South African gold mines were once notorious for their high death toll. But miners there have taken a relatively simple step. They announce that every time a colleague is killed, they will stop work at all the company's mines in that area for a day of mourning. Peter Bailey from the South African Miners Union says this has led to a marked drop in the number of accidents.
The National Union of Mine Workers took a decision and said, for every life lost, we must also lose productivity for one full day, losing millions of rands. That has then changed the mindset of the industry. They've put health and safety at the center stage, and no industry has the right to make me lose my life or my limbs. In the same fashion that I've left home this morning, I have the right to come back home and be with my family again.
That's Peter Bailey from the South African Miners Union, closing out that report from the BBC's Paul Moss. Let's take a quick look at some other stories in the news. The Nigerian man accused of trying to blow up that flight from Amsterdam to Detroit on Christmas Day represented himself for the first time today at a court hearing. Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab suggested in September that he wanted to plead guilty to some charges, but there was no discussion of that today. He'll be back in court in January. In France, students blockaded high schools and universities today, the third day of nationwide strikes, as protest against an increase in France's retirement age from 60 to 62. Students and labor unions see the reforms as an attack on the country's social security system. And students at the University of Mississippi are replacing their school's mascot. The Rebel Black Bear will replace Colonel Reb, that's the goateed southern gentleman who was banished from sporting events 7 years ago as part of the school's effort to distance itself from symbols of the Old South. The bear beat out two other finalists, the Rebel Land Shark and something called the Hadi Tadi, an attempt to personify the school cheer, which gives us a chance to play it. Someone call and explain that to us. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back.
We meet on the elevator in the Grand Theater. I look you in the eye and say, I'd like to see you later, but you don't understand. I take you to the Tate Museum. There's pictures there, but I can't see them. If you was there, I'd overlook the Roman Colosseum. It would not stand a chance.
That's the song The Grand Theater from the new CD of the same name by the Old 97s. It's garage rock meets British Invasion with a dash of twang. It was recorded as almost letters home as the band's lead singer traveled through theaters in Europe. It's the eighth CD since the band started out in Texas in the mid-90s. Now Rolling Stone says they've evolved into masterclass rock and roll songwriters. The Old 97s lineup includes lead singer and guitarist Rhett Miller, Murray Hammond on bass and vocals, and guitarist Ken Bethea and drummer Philip Peoples. And Rhett Miller and Murray Hammond join us from Cake Mix Recording in Dallas.
Robin.
So Robin Murray's the one with the Texas accent, and I'm the one that shook the Texas accent.
I shook it for a while.
So, Murray, why do you have the Texas accent and Rhett doesn't?
Yeah, Murray.
Yeah, I had a very, very Texas mother. Rhett's talked to my Texas mother. She was a very southern, genteel lady with an extremely thick country accent. And I grew up in a very small town where everybody, believe it or not, sounds much hickier than I do.
Oh, we didn't say hickey. You said that. And Rhett, yeah. why don't you have an accent?
By all rights, I should. I'm a seventh generation Texan, but I was an Anglophile. You should hear the record I made in high school that Murray produced. I was only listening to David Bowie and Aztec Camera, and I sounded like a Cockney Scott.
You're Dick Van Dyke on Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
The music.
There was a song called Seashell Girl, but you would never know that it wasn't about the winged creature that flies above the water. Seashell Gull keeps flying.
Seashell Gull.
The gull.
She picks up a pen. Writes down a word, it doesn't feel right. The novelty's gone, the novel rolls on into its good night.
So there you are in love with this English music when you're in high school. How did you come to the sound you have now? Did you veer off at one point through country and back to rock or something? How'd you get to this?
My personal journey did veer far away from country. I rejected everything that felt like it was part of Texas and this town that was keeping me down, and you know, because I felt like I was surrounded by football players and kids that would rather beat me up than talk about my favorite new record. And then it took Murray turning me on to, you know, Hank Williams to make me really appreciate the classic elegance of that sort of songwriting structure.
You know, I turned you on to a big one, Robin Hitchcock.
Well, yeah, that was a big part of my Anglophilia.
On a flexi disc. I remember that. It was flexi disc surgery.
Well, that song that we heard from the new CD, The Grand Theater?
Pronounce it how you will, Robin.
I
was Theatra.
But in that song, I'm also hearing, you know, sort of like the Clash. And then elsewhere on the CD, I'm hearing all these like clanging chords from almost a 50s sound. Let's listen to a little of The Magician.
The magician is trying to fool you. Politician is trying to rule. Talk to the real you. So when you could be mine.
It's punk until then it turns into Johnny Cash, rockabilly kind of stuff.
Well, speaking of Johnny Cash, Murray, you wrote and sing two songs on the new CD. One of them is called You Smoke Too Much. The other is You Were Born to Be in Battle. Let's just listen a little.
It's the spring of your time, and the time has come. The open road receives you. Won't you roll to a stop? Won't you gaze at the drop? And the awful miles below you.
It's funny you brought up Robin Hitchcock earlier. A few years ago, I got to hang out in his backyard, and we were all going around singing songs, and at one point he said, "So, Rhett, tell me, what is this thing called alternative country?" And I said, "Well," and I sang him a song. I sang him the song Victoria. off one of our RecuLife, an early record, because I said, I think this is probably what they're talking about when they say alternative country. Now that I hear You Were Born to Be in Battle, that's the song I would play for him.
Well, Rhett, I just want to ask you about one other thing. We've been, you know, big fans of your video blog, Rhett Miller TV on YouTube. Has one link that we'll link people up with at hereandnow.org. It's you sort of in this faux scene from the TV show The Office. You're on the set, you're in Michael's office, and Dwight and Pam come in and ask what you're doing there. Let's just listen for a couple seconds.
What are you doing in here?
Mine's
security. Can you get security?
Hey, Rain, we need to do a... who's this?
My name's Rhett Miller, and I sing in a band called Old 97s. We're kind of from Texas, and it's like rock and roll.
I mean, what?
Okay, questions. How'd this happen, and how much do people tell you you are like Jim?
That's hilarious.
You're Jim-like.
Well, the real story is that Rainn Wilson has amazing taste in music, and we've gotten to be friends over the last couple of years.
Rainn Wilson, who plays Dwight.
Yeah, and so I had a day off, and he asked me to come down to the set and hang out, and I'd been doing this video blog, so I thought it would be fun if I just shot one in the office, and he said, well, I'll jump in. And it just so happened that Jenna Fischer showed up right then, and it turns out they're both big fans of me and the 97s, and so it turned into a little scene. Although they were careful in the scene to identify themselves as Rain and Jenna so that it wasn't like a fake sort of office thing. Yeah. They didn't want to get in trouble, I guess.
You are so much like Jim, though. Do you feel Jim like Jim?
You know what? I think you're right. He is Jim.
What if the whole rest of the interview, Robin, was just like, no, but you're really like Jim.
No, you know what? You're Jim.
Well, actually, let's make the rest of the interview just talking a bit about Texas. You've got a great song, State of Texas. I know that all the songs on this new CD are sort of letters home written while you were on tour abroad. But, we talked about accents and stuff. Let's just bring it full circle. What does the state of Texas mean to you, Rhett?
I now live in New York. I'd moved to L.A. and New York City and back to L.A., and now I live in the Hudson Valley just north of Manhattan. And I love it, and I miss Texas a lot. I started thinking about how I really am proud of Texas, and even though I don't live there anymore, I feel a strong connection to it as an idea. So I set out to write the song as an homage. And that's why in the chorus it says I'm living in a state of Texas. Because even though I was living in and sitting in New York State while I was writing it, you know, it's the feeling of being proud of being a Texan.
Yeah, I know exactly what that is. I got a giant backyard where I live with really tall bushes. When you're back there, I just pretend I'm in Texas.
Where are you really? You're in Pasadena?
I'm in Pasadena, California, which I love, but I have my little Texas acre.
That's Murray Hammond, and we've also been speaking with Rhett Miller of the band The Old 97s. Their new CD is The Grand Theater, Volume 1. I just want to thank both of you for spending some time with us.
Thanks, Robin.
Yeah, thanks, Robin. Thanks for having us.
When the day breaks on Cedar Creek Lake, on my ride rolls into Rome. When the sun goes down on Austin Town, that's when I'll know I'm home. Oh, what a time we'll have on Greenville Ave with the big shots and Big D. I'm living in a state of Texas, and Texas lives in me.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Cousin Doe, my thoughts are with you today. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.